Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. So I hope you have your cup of coffee and whatever you normally eat for breakfast, and you're just sitting back and relaxing on this nice Saturday morning, listening to some very interesting topics, but even more interesting special guests who will join us at about a quarter past the hour. The show is brought to you by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia, serving the entire Washington, D.C. metro area with clients of all sizes located across the country. If you'd like to know more about our firm, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com. I also invite you to subscribe to my blog entitled blueprintforwealth.org, where there's a wealth of information on tax, estate planning, and business planning items of interest. We have it in video form, we have it in radio form, and we have it in written form, so that any one particular way that you enjoy learning about topics is available to you on the blog. And lastly, I'd like to invite you to read my article, my column in the Washington Business Journal every month entitled Blueprint for Wealth, where I have topics of interest in tax, estate planning, and business planning. Today, I'm going to continue a series of discussions on stock options. We've talked about stock options in the context of performance-based planning. We've talked about LLCs and how to incentivize employees with equity in LLCs. And today we're going to talk about pricing these stock options so that you don't run into problems under Section 409A, which I've talked about from time to time. Section 409A is an Internal Revenue Code section that was enacted way back in 2004, but it really has a lot of teeth today, particularly for privately held companies. It changed the income tax treatment of non-qualified stock options. Prior to the enactment of Section 409A, an optionee who was granted a non-qualified stock option merely was taxable on the spread between the exercise price, what was payable to purchase the options, and the underlying stock's fair market value at the time the optionee exercised the options at some point in time in the future. Section 409A changed the whole landscape and treatment of these non-qualified stock options. Today, an optionee who's granted a non-qualified option may be subject to immediate income taxation in the year the non-qualified stock option vests and in subsequent years prior to exercise if the option's underlying stock value has increased. In addition, the optionee could be subject to a 20% excise tax plus interest. And a company that grants a non-qualified stock option that's subject to this 409A rule also may have adverse tax consequences if it fails to adequately withhold these taxes on the date of grant. Fortunately, non-qualified options that are granted with an exercise price which is not less than fair market value on the date of grant are exempt from Section 409A. So the key is coming up with a valuation of the underlying stock for the non-qualified option so that it equals or exceeds the fair market value of the stock. In the old days, the IRS and the Securities and Exchange Commission permitted the fair market value of common stock of a privately held company to be set by loosely estimating an appropriate discount from the price of recently issued preferred stock based on the company's early stage of development. In those days, in the old days, it was often used, the discount was often 90%. So if the preferred stock was issued for a dollar, the common stock was deemed to be viewed as worth only 10% of the preferred stock. This practice was stopped in the proposed regulations and again in the final regulations that were issued by the IRS in 2005 and 2007. Now, the fair market value of common stock of a privately held company has to be based on a reasonable valuation method that are set forth in the regulations. Under the regulations, a valuation method is a reasonable valuation method if it considers the following factors. the value of tangible and intangible assets of the company, the present value of future cash flows of the company, the market value of stock or equity interests in similar companies engaged in similar businesses, recent arm's length transactions involving the sale or transfer of stock or equity interests, like if you actually issued stock to a person who paid cash for it, control premiums or discounts for lack of marketability or minority interests, and whether the valuation method is used for other purposes that can have a material economic effect on the company, its stockholders, or its creditors. So this general rule under the regulations says that the use of a valuation is not reasonable if it fails to reflect information available after the date of calculation that may materially affect the value of the company, or the value was calculated more than 12 months earlier than the date on which it's being used. So one general rule is any valuation that you're using needs to be... So the general rule is that you better make sure your valuation is not more than 12 months old. Now, there are a bunch of safe harbor methods that are issued under the regulations or listed under the regulations. These safe harbors include, of course, a valuation by an independent appraiser if it's at least, if it's no more than 12 months old. A second safe harbor is a reasonable, good faith written valuation of a startup company. Now, a startup company is generally referred to as a private company that's less than 10 years old. And it's reasonable if it's done in good faith and evidenced by a written report. It's going to be presumed reasonable, which is good, meaning that the IRS can't really attack it successfully, if the following requirements are satisfied. The valuation takes into account the valuation factors that I just mentioned under the general rule, like present value of cash flows for the future. And it also considers events subsequent to the valuation that may render an earlier valuation inapplicable. A valuation is reasonable if it's performed by a person who has significant knowledge and experience and education or training in performing similar valuations. The experience generally means at least 5 years of relevant experience in business valuations or appraisals or financial accounting or investment banking or private equity or secured lending or other comparable experience in the line of business or industry in which the company normally operates. Another important factor in determining the reasonableness of a valuation for a startup, a company that's less than 10 years old, is that the stock that's being valued is not subject to any put or call rights, meaning that the investor doesn't have the right to force the company to buy back the investor's shares at a specific price, other than, say, a right of first refusal or a right to repurchase the stock of an employee upon offer to purchase by a third party who makes an offer to buy that stock. It's also a reasonable valuation if the company does not reasonably anticipate at the time the valuation is made that the company is going to undergo a change in control within 90 days following the grant or make a public offering of its stock within 180 days. In other words, if they issue a stock option and they do a valuation, but then within 90 days the company is sold, the valuation or the appraisal may not be considered to be reasonable if it, unless it's being conducted by an independent third-party appraiser. And even then, I'd be very careful about that. There's another safe harbor available. It's known as the formula method, and it's available for companies that use a formula based on book value or a reasonable multiple of earnings, say 3 times their earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, or a combination of the two to set the option exercise price. The formula method is not available unless the stock acquired is subject to a permanent restriction on transfer, which requires the holder to sell or otherwise transfer the stock back to the company at a price determined under this same formula. And the formula is used consistently by the company for that class of stock for all transfers to the company or any person who possesses more than 10% of the value of the voting stock of the company. So commentators generally believe that the formula method is not going to be widely employed because of the restrictive conditions on it, on its use. For startups, it's unavailable because they may neither have a book value or earnings. In other words, startup companies are often generating losses at the early stage. But many of our clients that are service companies are generating profits right out of the box. And I believe that the formula method can be employed as long as the restrictions are satisfied. In an apparent attempt to alleviate some of the angst that private companies and advisors were expressing regarding compliance with these 409A rules, the IRS issued some guidance that adopts differing valuation standards depending on when the options were issued. The bottom line is that for any new options that are being issued today, after 2007 in particular, you have to use the general rule or the safe harbors. To avoid any problems, you may want to go ahead and get an appraiser to do this. But the problem is, how do you afford to pay for an appraiser, particularly if you're a startup company? What do you do? Well, in the intermediate stage of growth, you may want to opt for the maximum certainty that an appraisal affords and pay for it. It might cost you between $5,000 and $10,000 a year to do this, but it may be worth it to avoid the angst that could be generated on IRS audit. For the startups, consider the formula method as long as you can meet the restrictions. If you've got questions on valuing your stock options and how to go about approaching this, give us a call at 703-218-2100. I'm Wayne Zell, and you're listening to Blueprint for Wealth.